You're listening to The Diplomat's podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host, Ankit Panda, an editor at The Diplomat, and I'm happy to say I'm joined today by Adam Cathcart, editor-in-chief of SinoNK.com and a lecturer in Chinese history at the University of Leeds. Adam, thanks a lot for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for the invitation, Ankit.
We're very happy to have you since we haven't had a podcast on North Korea in some time. Listeners might note that Adam recently authored an article on relations between China and North Korea for The Diplomat in which he assesses Pyongyang's ground game in the Chinese capital. And I believe I'll ask him to go into a bit more detail on that, but that essentially means the extent to which North Korea is still pursuing some sort of planned and considered approach towards Beijing that is being met with serious consideration in the Chinese capital. We'll get into Adam's article and more in detail over the course of this podcast. But first, a bit of background. Regular readers of The Diplomat and watchers of Northeast Asian security and international affairs might in general have noted that since late 2013, relations between North Korea and China, the country's historical benefactor and closest partner and ally, have not been quite what they used to be, beginning perhaps with the purge and execution of Kim Jong-un's erstwhile number two, Jang Song-taek, who was also his uncle, incidentally. But perhaps even earlier than that, relations between Pyongyang and Beijing began to decline. Most recently, we saw how North Korea's envoy, Cho Ryong-hae, was given a bit of the cold shoulder treatment when he was in Beijing for China's parade commemorating the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War in Asia. Instead, we saw Chinese President Xi Jinping give considerable attention to South Korean President Park Geun-hye. And this begs the question, is China beginning to up its relations with Seoul at the expense of its historical ties with Pyongyang? And Adam will obviously be able to give us more insight on that. Now, in understanding why China and North Korea are where they are today, it's not an easy question to have a grasp around, and one really needs to have an insight into the region's history, North Korean politics, Chinese foreign policy, and inter-Korean relations. And fortunately, Adam, in my perception, happens to have an excellent grasp on all of these topics, so we're very happy to have him on today. So Adam, I'm going to stop talking and pass the mic over to you. And I should note that for our listeners, since we are talking about North Korea and developments inside North Korea, always tend to be a little bit opaque. Much of this podcast will be an exercise in informed tea leaf reading, and I want to emphasize the informed part of that. It's always tough to say with any high degree of certainty what's driving the North Korean leadership's decision-making, but there is a devoted community of North Korea watchers out there, and Adam's at the center of it all. So with that said, Adam, just by way of background for our listeners, could you just chart the trajectory of the relationship between China and North Korea since Kim Jong-un took over Pyongyang from his father? How has the relationship come to the point that it's at today?
Well, I think, thank you for the question, and I think that it's a very important one in terms of assessing the so-called Kim Jong-un era, right, because he's been in power coming up on 4 years now, and he's been around long enough where we're starting to get a sense of is there kind of a distinctive Kim Jong-un approach to foreign policy, or is he more or less sort of using the so-called the North Korean playbook, or just following sort of in the footsteps of his father and his grandfather before him. So I think when we're trying to understand what their approach is from Pyongyang looking at Beijing, and it's a really complicated problem for the North Koreans, because on the one hand, this is your big business trading partner. It's essential if you're going to reconstruct and revive the consumer economy in North Korea that Chinese goods are a part of that. Without taking in all the sort of what they call cultural baggage, I suppose, and cultural infiltration from the North Korean Chinese border, from both China and from the West via China, so it's a really complex problem for them. At the same time, if you think, you know, politically and geopolitically around the region, this is their oldest ally, and it's a kind of a shield for them against so many problems. I mean, such basic things as they need help at the UN, and they need to make sure that they've got those vetoes in place against human rights resolutions that seek to, you know, push into North Korea's sovereign space. So for all those reasons, it's a very important relationship. Since Kim Jong-un came to power, I would argue that relations have gone in a negative direction, certainly. And you've got to recall, I think, you know, periodization as a historian is something we always talk about. When did something begin? When is it ending? Those are consequential debates for Chinese-North Korean relations, because if you think about the Kim Jong-un era, he's been around more or less since 2009 and 2010, but not as a real power player in Pyongyang. And he met some Chinese officials. There's not much, they don't really have a sense of him preceding 2011, and they haven't given him much access, that being sort of North Korea's handlers of the Kim Jong-un leadership. They haven't given him much access to Beijing. There haven't been too many trips or bilateral decisions. So even dating back, if you go back to 2009, 2010, China was not so happy to see hereditary leadership transfer yet again from Kim Jong-il to his son. And they were kind of hoping for a collective leadership to emerge. And I think there was some interest in Jang Song-taek and others around Jang Song-taek, including his wife, Kim Kyung-hee, and others.
Now, just very briefly, can you go a bit into Jang? Because, you know, Jang was said for the longest time to be Beijing's man in Pyongyang. He was the primary interlocutor between the two sides. What was the significance of Jang Song-taek in this relationship?
Well, Jang had gotten into trouble in a few instances prior to his return. Kim Jong-il sort of brought him back, and the consensus seems to be that Kim Jong-il brought him back because they needed a kind of a transitional figure. He was trusted at the top, and he was seen from the Chinese side as being at least interested in questions of economic reform, maybe some special economic zones and things of that nature. And he was, in fact, tasked with North Korea's side of running a special economic zone on the Chinese-North Korean border near the city of Dandong and the North Korean city of Sinuiju at the so-called Hwanggumpyeon Island. It was actually, in fact, two islands. And that was kind of the point of contact or the tip of the spear, so to speak, in terms of what the Chinese leadership had hoped for, which is a gradual liberalization of the North Korean economy and opening up, kind of an explicit opening up of more special economic zones, the use of the Chinese yuan on North Korean territory that would be sanctioned by the state. There's Chinese scholars writing about this, very interested in it. Yuanization is a big deal in DPRK, and it's not something the government officially likes, the North Korean government officially likes to acknowledge is happening. But someone like Jang was seen as being a conduit for those kind of policies. Now, I don't think that he was beloved by any stretch of the imagination. And much like the people around Stalin, when they're gotten rid of, suddenly they become liberal in the mind of the observer, right? Somehow they were people who we could have done business with, and what we're left with is a much stronger sort of dictatorship, and so they're left looking all the better by default. So, by way of wrapping up my answer to this question, I would also say from the Chinese side, there's discouragement that Jang was purged, and we still don't really know why exactly. And there's a number of rumors and ideas about why that happened. And Chinese analysts will tell you regularly, even today, you know, we were upset by this. It really hurt the business relationship. It takes time to rebuild connections. But at the same time, if you look at the numbers, Sino-North Korean trade did rebound. It took about 6 months. So things are kind of back to quote-unquote normal in this rather abnormal relationship.
Great. Well, thanks for that helpful background, Adam. Now, for the next step of this podcast, I want to ask you about two individuals who have come to acquire a new prominence in the North Korean power structure, in my understanding. So the first of these I mentioned earlier, Cho Rong-hae, who was Pyongyang's envoy to Beijing's parade. I want you to just appraise, you know, his role within the regime. And the second is actually Hwang Pyeong-so, who, in my understanding, is now de facto the second in charge now, sort of taking, you know, Jang Song-taek's old role on. I know it's difficult to precisely say who is number two in North Korea, but Hwang seems to be the person that a lot of people are saying is this person. So could you just give your appraisal of these two gentlemen and their role within Pyongyang's power structure?
Sure. And I think in both cases, they appear to indicate party supremacy over the army. I think that's an important point. I mean, Hwang Pyeong-so and Choe Rong-hae have, you know, they wear the KPA general's uniform from time to time. Hwang in particular is tasked with kind of keeping the political spine of the army straight. He's also kind of the top political commissar, if you will, for the KPA, and that's a really important position, but it's one that he arrived at via the party. So in both cases, there is a certain, you know, when people sometimes will ask you, is there a military coup in the works? Is the KPA, the Korean People's Army, or Inmingun going to take over the government? And we don't see that. And in every case, both in terms of iconography and in terms of policy, it seems that Kim Jong-un is in very much in favor of the party controlling the army. So that's one aspect that I think unites them. Hwang Pyeong-so is less well-known than Choe Rong-hae because he hasn't been in the public eye for as long. It's a perilous place to be, obviously, number two in North Korea. Kim Jong-un seems quite notorious now for being mercurial and rather demanding, and it's very easy to make a slip-up. I mean, if you read Jang Song-taek's, the uncle's, more or less his execution warrant, one of the very many things for which he was accused of disloyalty and of wanting to overthrow the state, effectively, was in his lack of attention to the personality cult and his lack of respect for Kim Jong-un and for the Kim family in general. So Hwang Byung-so seems to have been able to avoid those types of things, and he's very much at the center of all things at the moment, doing a few less ceremonial things than Choi Ryong-hae. The one thing I would add that distinguishes the two of them is that Che comes from this guerrilla background. He's a more well-known figure because his father fought in the anti-Japanese guerrilla army with Kim Il-sung. And while in our politics in the United States or in the UK, the history of what people's grandparents were doing in the 20s and 30s may be of sort of academic interest, I think that in terms of political power and in terms of political safety, it's very hard to underestimate Choi Ryong-hae's power there, because the power of his father's example, having actually been a general fighting with alongside Kim Il-sung. So I think they're both, in terms of what they do on a day-to-day level, you'll hear different ideas. Both of them have met with South Koreans in the last year or two, and so their role in inter-Korean relations has been very important. Of course, Kim Jong-un has yet to really have a proper summit with a bilateral leader, much less Park Geun-hye. So these are important. I would argue that they're not puppet masters, that they are basically extensions of the Kim family leadership, and that they are guardians of it very much in the conservative vein.
Great. Now, going back to the article that you wrote for The Diplomat, which again, I encourage listeners to read through. So you wrote that article before the September 3rd parade in Beijing. And now I kind of want to get a sense of, you know, your postmortem of that incident. So, you know, obviously, Che wasn't given the sort of superstar treatment that he might have liked, or Kim Jong-un would have liked to have seen. Instead, we saw Xi Jinping give Park Geun-hye essentially center stage. So what is your appraisal of, you know, North Korea's ground game, as you called it, with Beijing after this parade and Che's treatment there?
Well, I think there's a lot at stake when it comes to this kind of event, most of all because it's China sort of setting up the playing field. I mean, this is as explicit as it gets in terms of, these are who we honor, this is who we want to stand next to, this is kind of the lineup, as it were, of our friends, people who are willing to be seen with us. And in terms of the relationship with South Korea having really grown and thrived in so many ways economically since normalization, which happened in 1992, North Korea was upset about it then. They're still upset about the Chinese-South Korean relationship. And within that environment and that warming trend, and Park Geun-hye having done some rather intelligent things, I would argue, to kind of get herself on that podium and to make it seen within China as being a very logical step, within the PRC's own framework and his way of looking at history, I would argue that it's a big deal from the standpoint of the North Koreans, because you can essentially see that, wow, South Korea is really making inroads here. There's a much better discourse and ethos, rather, that's in place and a personal relationship between Park Geun-hye and Xi Jinping. And that, of course, you know, look at the way the PRC works. I mean, in South Korea, I think it's difficult to say that there's some great China wave, or that this is all creating kind of praise and excitement about the South Korean relationship with China. I mean, people are a little more cagey than that, I would argue, in Seoul. But on the Chinese side, all the officials are supposed to be looking at, South Korea as more or less a friendly partner. And so that's a problem for DPRK, and that's a problem from the standpoint of the North Korean leadership. In terms of how they want to approach fixing it or ameliorating the kind of the inroads, that's the tricky point. And there's so much we don't know. You mentioned tea leaf reading. Did Choi Ryong-hye bring a letter from Kim Jong-un to hand to Xi Jinping? Maybe he didn't have such a letter or any kind of message at all, which is why he was so, you know, pushed all the way down the podium and didn't get a meeting with Xi Jinping. But as Chinese officials will remind me, when I come to them and I talk to, you know, friends who are at lower levels of Beijing city government even, and you'll talk about, oh, the Chinese-North Korean relationship, they'll say, you've got to remember Japan is the big fish in the region. North Korea is a bothersome irritant in our way of looking at the world at the moment. And if we don't have to deal with it, we won't.
Great. So Adam, before I forget, I want to ask you about another personality who's often overlooked in the Sino-NK relationship, which is the Chinese ambassador in Pyongyang, Li Jiangjun, currently. Could you talk a bit about his role in this relationship and how he's been navigating the tough job of being China's top representative in Pyongyang?
Yeah, well, he's relatively new to the job, and he was put in place this last spring. There have been some rumors floating around, and even people like Heritage Foundation's Bruce Clinger have been talking to South Korean officials who will tell him and will tell anybody that there's a crisis in Chinese-North Korean relations because the Chinese ambassador has yet to have his credentials validated by the North Koreans, which is just a flat-out lie. There was a ceremony whereby he had his credentials received by Kim Yong-nam, who is the sort of ceremonial president of the DPRK, and that was back in March. And since then, he's been doing the things that Chinese ambassadors do in Pyongyang. There's a lot of waiting around. He did have one kind of significant meeting where he talked about China's One Belt, One Road strategy, this Yi Dai Yi Lu concept that Xi Jinping has really been pushing, the notion of kind of China linking up with all of its peripheral areas and trade zones, high-speed rail, things like that. Apart from that one statement, which the North Koreans never amplified or expanded upon, it seems that he's been more or less in a box, along with Chinese journalists who are there and Chinese military attachés. They are watched just as carefully, if not more carefully, than anybody in Pyongyang. But he's done a number of things. He wrote an article about the anti-Japanese experience of World War II, where North Korea and the Chinese Communist Party, or the North Korean Workers' Party and the Chinese Communist Party, prior to becoming states, you know, fought the Japanese together. And so he's trying to set up business ties. He's trying to reinforce historical links. But most of all, he's just trying to get a meeting.
Great. No, that's definitely very useful context. Now, you know, when thinking about this new normal in relations between China and North Korea, like you said, things have taken a turn for the worse. How do you see things getting better, if at all? Is this a new normal that's here to stay for perhaps decades, or will we see some sort of change? And will this change require initiative from Pyongyang's side? It seems like Beijing is essentially limited in the extent to which it can talk to North Korea at this point. So will we have to see Pyongyang take the initiative?
That's a great question. I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, you know, China's a stakeholder in global affairs. Essentially, what they want in North Korea is what we want. And by we, I mean the West, generally speaking. What is North Korea going to do to open up its economy? What are they going to do to open up the information spigots? We want more people-to-people ties. We want more North Koreans going abroad and studying abroad and more foreign ideas circulating in DPRK. That seems to be something that China and the United States, UK, Western Europe, EU, and certainly Japan and South Korea would all more or less agree with. And that this is one path towards, in some cases, this is where the division comes, one path towards a stronger North Korea and one that is more more liberal, so to speak. As opposed to sort of, you know, strangle them until they collapse, which is another school of thought. And I think China and more or less the Western interests and influences are on the same side of the ledger on that question. In other words, we're waiting for the North Koreans to kind of walk into that open door that China has created to set up, go into those special economic zones to allow more people out, more visas in, less surveillance of people who are inside the country, et cetera. I got a little lost, Ankit, in answering that.
No worries. Actually, you know, when you were mentioning this list of countries, I noted that you left out Russia. And
yeah.
We've seen a lot of commentary that Russia is beginning to take an opportunity, seize this rift between China and North Korea as an opportunity to swoop in. Obviously, Russia in the past year and a half, as China and North Korea have been driven apart, has itself become isolated from the West, obviously over its actions in Ukraine and Syria and elsewhere. So do you think that there is anything to that, or is this being overhyped by commentators that maybe aren't so familiar with North Korea's approach to the region? Is Russia in a position to take an advantage of this situation and become North Korea's new benefactor or partner?
Well, I think the context that you mentioned is absolutely vital to trying to understand why Russia is doing what it's doing and why the North Koreans have been so receptive to Moscow, certainly in the last few years. I mean, that's not a new thing, but there was some debt forgiveness. There are some industrial projects. There's a railway project. The problem is that what North Korea has, minerals, Russia also has. And it's not, I mean, look at the population of the Russian Far East. I mean, it's, you know, you're talking, you know, this is not even the size of a small Scandinavian country in the end. So you're not talking about some massive mega power out there. You're talking about Vladivostok and a couple other small cities along the coast and some really peripheral places like Khabarovsk, which is closer to China. I mean, China is going to be the main player because it is the big weight in the region and it is the major counterweight and partner to North Korea. So I think that that's a question that is really, really interesting because it can lead to North Korea getting things like jet fuel and a certain amount of help at the UN. I mean, that UN Security Council veto still really matters. So even if China were to peel off somehow and threaten North Korea and say, we're not going to support you, if the North Koreans have the Russians in their corner, there's at least that last backstop that they've got. You know, to come back to something that you asked me earlier, though, about normal, is this the new normal? One thing that China has done that has angered the North Koreans, right? Because I mentioned, well, China's basically doing what we want them to do, and there's an open door for the North Koreans. It's not like the Chinese have angered the North Koreans in any way. They have angered the North Koreans by warming up with South Korea and also by calling the relationship more normal, right? We want this to be on a less on a party-to-party basis, but on a country-to-country basis. So we want to go through foreign ministries to talk to one another. We want, quote-unquote, normal channels. We don't want the international liaison department or party-to-party relations to basically be the main conduit. So that's another thing that's sort of made the North Koreans upset.
Great. And Adam, just by, you know, we're going to take this podcast to a wrap soon, but I just wanted to ask you by way of a closing question, and this is a bit of an inevitable topic when we're talking about North Korea, which is the nuclear question, specifically the six-party talks, which have been moribund for years. You know, essentially, I like the way you put it in your article. They've been in zombie mode, I believe you said. And, you know, we've seen all the stakeholders in the six-party process come to different conclusions. The United States has insisted on preconditions for North Korea to come back to the table. It has to show that it's going to make some sort of good faith effort towards denuclearization. And China, in the meanwhile, has been saying, let's go back to talks unconditionally. What's your appraisal of where things are with denuclearization and the international diplomatic process?
Well, China has been very much pushing for denuclearization as well, and that allegedly is their bottom line. The problem with China, and this is the problem with China writ large throughout in the last century, I suppose, is that does the periphery do what the center asks? So if the Chinese central government is making noise about denuclearization and telling the North Koreans we're going to buckle down when it comes to sanctions, who's controlling the customs houses, right? Who's watching goods going across the river, the Yalu or the Tumen River, or being shipped, as is increasingly happening between Dalian and Nampo, the North Korean port? So Dalian is kind of acting, and as some people in UN panel of experts say, as kind of a offshore, more or less a third place where North Korea is doing a huge amount of shipping activity and where goods get sort of moved surreptitiously into DPRK via. So the nuclear question is really important, but in terms of putting pressure on North Korea, so much of it comes down to how open is that spigot? How closely is cargo being inspected? I mean, this is a big border. If you go up and down the Chinese-North Korean border, it's big. They've got more and more infrastructure on the border on the Chinese side. There's the capacity to move things through various points. There were mobile missile launchers that the North Koreans paraded in 2013 that shocked the world that certainly came via China and probably via the PLA. So are people in the PLA, the People's Liberation Army in China, committed to you know, the sanctions effort, etc.? So I think that that's one way of answering the question. The other way is to look at Chinese expert opinion, people like Zhang Lianghui and Liu Chao. There's some voices that are quite prominent in the Chinese media and outlets like Huangqiu Shibao, the Global Times, but also in Shijie Zhishi, which is a really interesting journal done by the Chinese Foreign Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And they are very, very upset about the lack of denuclearization, the lack of movement on talks, And Jiang Liangwei put it best. He got very upset in 2013 when the North Koreans sent one of their key nuclear negotiators to Beijing for an anniversary event of the six-party talks. I mean, that's what I mean when it's zombie mode, right? We're going to celebrate the anniversary of something that never really succeeded. And here he is, the North Korean representative is there, and the Jiang Liangwei, the Chinese expert, says, "You are not the manager. You are trying to become the managers. You are the managed. We are going to, you know, be the arbiters of your nuclear program." So I think that China talking like a big power, the North Koreans are I think they're hearing it, but they're not listening. And that's kind of where we're stuck.
Well, Adam, on behalf of all our listeners, thanks a lot for your insight. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thanks a lot for joining me.
Anytime. Thank you, Ankit.
Great. And if you like this podcast, please do give us a rating and a review on iTunes. And you can follow me on Twitter at NKTPND and Adam at Adam Cathcart. Adam's Twitter feed has been a source of a lot of information for me over the years, so I definitely recommend that you follow him if you're interested in North Korea or watching North Korea. Thanks a lot for listening, and thank you again, Adam.
Anytime. Thank you.